You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a guest rogue this week, Joshi Berger. Joshi, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Wow, what an honor to be here, sincerely.
Thanks. So Joshi is an active member of the New York City Skeptics, a comedian, very active in the skeptical community, and is the recent winner of the Worst Cooks in America on the Food Channel, which is quite something.
Oh, yeah. Yay. Quite something. Jay, first of all, thank you very much. Thank you, Steve. Bob, you know what? With my luck, I find out there's a hot, funny girl on the show, and there I go. I end up with three brothers and a Jew. Yeah, my luck. Excellent.
Rebecca is having some back problems tonight and can't be on the show.
Feel better, Rebecca.
No yeah, relation to Josh's appearance on the show.
Right.
As far as you know.
Yeah. As far as we know, right.
So tell us, how did you end up winning this reality TV show? Tell us about that.
Well, I ended up winning by cooking a fabulous dish. But the real question, I assume, is how did I persevere over the other 15 contestants? And I guess being in yeshiva, for those that don't know, that's an Orthodox Jewish school for kids, for 18 years sort of prepares you for life better than other people. I mean, I guess it would be similar to having a Palestinian on the Fear Factor, right? I think they would win every time. But was that inappropriate? I'm sorry. I love my Palestinian Semitic.
It's a great
brothers.
Analogy.
It is. It is. No, but the truth be told, I grew up in a kosher household. I grew up thinking that everything is disgusting that we don't eat. I would not kiss girlfriends that ate shrimp, and I was literally repulsed by it to the point that I couldn't look at it. I mean, I had one line that's being repeated online now where I referred to shrimp as cockroach on steroids. And I really think it is that. They're just, I mean, crustaceans, they're an abomination.
They're arthropods. They're in the same phylum as cockroaches.
They feed other fish that we do love, though.
Yes, and a bunch of other words we didn't learn in yeshiva. But when I went into boot camp, which is what we did, we woke up early in the morning and we cooked a lot. And I had so many issues that other people didn't have. They merely didn't know how to cook. I didn't know how to cook. Plus, I was repulsed by so many things, and I wasn't allowed to mix meat with cheese and other things. I think me overcoming those things that for 27 years of my life I was repulsed by made the cooking part really easy. So once I overcame those things, I think I had extreme confidence that I would win the show, and I did.
So you're currently a non-believing heathen, right? But you were raised a Orthodox Jew?
Yes, I was raised in Brooklyn, New York, and I never know how much of Orthodox Judaism I have to explain to people, because where I grew up, all my friends were Orthodox Jewish. I had no non-Jewish friends. I had no friends that weren't Orthodox, because, I mean, the type of yarmulke or skullcap that you wore determined how religious you were. So, I mean, we had a cloth yarmulke that had to have two parts to it, meaning a top and a bottom. And if I had friends that had a leather yarmulke or a knitted yarmulke, they weren't welcome in my home. I mean, I wouldn't say that, but, you know, we wouldn't be able to be really friends. Friendly. They were more modern, and you know, they probably had TVs at home, which we didn't.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's terrible. So, but the really difficult thing for me to deal with is the fact that I was a skeptic my entire life. I was the kid that when my mom came home from Israel and she said that she had a seance with some lady that was able to get spirits in the room from her aunt and stuff moved and stuff, I was the first kid that said, oh, come on, Mom, it's bullshit. You know that didn't happen. And she's like, how can you say that? I saw cups moving. And the skeptic inside me immediately was able to find the logical fallacies she was making, the things that she perhaps thought she was remembering that she wasn't, everything across the board. I mean, my parents were huge fans of Uri Geller. And it's Uri, by the way, not Uri. It's infuriating when people call him Uri. When my parents would talk about Uri Geller and say how he drove around Tel Aviv with a blindfold, I was like, it wasn't a blindfold. How many times did you see people have something around their head when it really wasn't a blindfold? Like, for all you sports fans, Cedric Ceballos won the slam dunk contest by having a blindfold when he admitted afterwards, and it was obvious to skeptics that he was able to see through it. But the most obvious things that I should have been aware of, I wasn't. And I'm so ashamed of it now. I mean, I'm a grown adult now that has to come to grips with the fact that I at one point believed that a 90-year-old man with his three kids took all the animals in the world on a boat ride. I believed that, and not only did I believe it, I was the person that everyone called to argue against people that didn't believe in it. And you know what? Kudos to religion for doing such an awesome job on being able to convince people that are smart, intelligent, and skeptical that the stuff that they're doing that's ridiculous is not something to be analyzed too carefully.
Joshy, when did you realize that your religion really wasn't working for you anymore?
You know, people ask me that, and it really wasn't one of those straw that broke the camel backs type of moments. It really was... I have to give all the credit to the internet, to be honest. And religion has been doing, especially Orthodox Judaism, I can't really speak for other religions, has been doing an incredible job of really protecting information. I mean, I give the analogy of, you know, when a kid wants candy and he's short, you can put it on a higher shelf and then on a higher shelf. But eventually the kid's going to be tall enough to reach all the shelves and you can't hide the candy from him anymore. And now with the internet out there, I think information is literally impossible to keep away from people. And that's what happened to me. And I think, thankfully, that's what's happening to many, many communities around the world where there was a stranglehold on people, information was kept from them, but now the internet is really, really destroying these communities. And I'm happy. There are cracks in communities that I thought were destined to suffer, like, you know, like I did, like my friends did, that I really see are coming apart. And, you know, the internet is really the answer of what allowed me to access all this information.
So it just crept up on you, just the information over time began to ring true?
It was more about, we've always been taught from a young age that Jews are the smartest, Jews are the best, why do you think Jews win all the Nobel Prizes, it must be with the chosen people and all that stuff. Where in reality, Orthodox Jews really, I believe, ride the coattails of secular Jews. I mean, when you look at Albert Einstein, he was a deist at best. When you look at Spinoza, when you look at great Jewish minds, even today, like Steven Pinker and other people, these guys are all Jewish. They're culturally Jewish. They're not ashamed of the Judaism. Even someone like Christopher Hitchens, when he finds out about it, is proud of the traditions. But it's unfair for Jews to latch onto the coattails of successful Jews that are preaching the exact opposite of what they're preaching and use that as weapons for, look, we must be right because Jews are so great and so forth. And when I found that out, when I saw that some of the greatest Jewish thinkers throughout history have not really believed in the stuff that I was being force-fed, that really made me re-examine everything. And once I pulled the thread, everything came apart really quickly.
That's a pretty powerful story. I mean, what you described has, I'm sure, happened to many people that listen to the show. You know, it's part of a typical or common journey a lot of us go through. But I think that the thing that your story tells that a lot of people haven't experienced is, you know, there's not that many people that have that incredible intensity and total immersion in their religion. I mean, we've had a few people tell us about being a fundamental Christian and things like that. And I would probably make those things kind of even in my head. But even still, I think the level of immersion you're describing is even deeper than what a lot of people think is deep.
Yeah, I'll give you one example, and it's comedic to a point. And there is, I mean, I think Jews do a great job, like I was saying. You know, you put on a yarmulke at a young age, so you look different, and you don't challenge how people look. But one of the commandments in the Bible is that if you have any article of clothing that has four edges on it, that you have to put, like, strings on it, it's called tzitzis. most of us don't have articles of clothing that are four cornered these days, except for scarves, and there's rabbinical discussions whether a scarf is considered an article of clothing or an accessory. But, you know, again, those were people that didn't have real jobs. They had to come up with arguments a long time ago. But what the Orthodox community has adopted, that if God made the determination that this would make him happy, that perhaps we should all intentionally wear clothes that have four edges on it, just so that we can get the commandment of putting strings on them. So all Orthodox Jews, you don't see this because most of them tuck them into the pants, but between their undershirt and their shirt, they wear an additional article of clothing called tzitzis, which is just pretty much, it's like a scarf with a hole in it that you could put your head through, and it has strings on it.
Oh, I thought that was for...
No. Jay, we'll get to that and the whole myth of Orthodox people having sex with sheets, which all just started with a bad Halloween party. But the funny thing about this is that one of the most renowned rabbis in Israel, his name is Rabbi Sheinberg. He is literally one of the people that people go to with important questions. We're not talking about simple questions. He decides really important issues in Orthodoxy. He made the determination that if God wants you to wear this one article of clothing as an accessory and he's happy with it, imagine if I wore more than one. This is not a joke, what I'm about to tell you. This rabbi wears over 100 tzitzis on him. Nobody knows the exact number, but he looks like he weighs 400-500 pounds, but he's really a 95-pound little guy that's a great mind, a genius amongst Jews, that has hundreds of tzitzis on his body. Now, like Christopher Hitchens says, this is a guy that should be selling pens and screaming in the corner of Times Square. But religion, somehow, when I even make fun of him, my brothers say, how can you make fun of Rabbi Sheinberg? He's such a genius. He's such a holy man. But if the tables were turned and if some imam would be wearing 100 pairs of shoes and would be parading around, my brother would not stop laughing at him. So, I mean, there is something that religion does really well in taking intelligent, skeptical people and totally making them not realize how absurd their behavior is.
Josh, what if like some guy just rolled into that rabbi's church and he's like, I'm wearing 101.
Evan's
his synagogue.
Class.
He's like, right. I got 101.
He's holier than thou.
You know what? Actually, before I was doing this, I was talking to BJ, and I said, how many does he wear? And BJ, that studied in his yeshiva, BJ, one of my great friends, said, you know what? It's actually not known how many he wears. And now I understand why. Maybe he doesn't want anyone to know, so nobody can upstage him. So now he could say, I win 103. Screw you. I win. Yeah. So we don't know.
Jeez. It's a mystery.
Joshy, I just wanted to tell my co-host here how great it's been to get to know you over the past year and just watch you evolve.
Thank you so much. And I remember I used to listen to talk radio a lot. And actually, English is my third language. I spoke Hebrew and then I spoke Yiddish. And many people ask me, what's your accent? And it's not an accent. It's just I don't speak properly because I started speaking English much later in life. I guess it's Yiddish and it's like Jackie Mason meets Joe Pesci or something.
That's awesome.
But I'm just so glad that I found a movement that I'm passionate about because this really filled the void that I had. To me, skepticism and having people realize how beautiful life is when you don't hinge yourself onto things that are ridiculous is the motivating force to my life. So thank you guys.
Agreed.
Forget me. Well, thank you guys.
Well, that's a great transition point. So Evan, we didn't skip you. We need a This Day in Skepticism.
I was just sitting here fascinated by Josh's story. Right? I was ready to get popcorn. I could have gone for more. On February 26, 1616, it was Cardinal Bellarmine.
There were three sixes in that date, Evan. Are you aware of that?
There is, and two twos. Oh, my gosh. Numerologists are going crazy. And the devil, too. Cardinal Bellarmine warned Galileo Galilei not to hold, teach, or defend Copernican theory that the Earth revolved around the sun.
Right.
Now, this is relevant, especially with recent news, in which a poll of Russians was reported that 32% of them still believe that the sun goes around the Earth. So congratulations to the good cardinal at the time for having his influence reign supreme, at least in 30% of Russians over 400 years.
And 20% of Americans, we found out.
Yeah, 20% of Americans, too.
It's not shocking. My girlfriend's Russian. I think they all believe everything revolves around them.
It's really disheartening, though. I mean, but, you know, before, Josh, he was talking about how the internet played a role in his awakening. And when you think about how ubiquitous this information is, I mean, you can't even, if you look up anything on the internet that has to do with astronomy, you're gonna find out that the Earth revolves around the sun at some point. I mean, obviously,
yeah. I mean, I think it is almost unbelievable that somebody could walk through life for any amount of time to get to adulthood and not understand certain basic fundamental things about the world in which we live, like the fact that the Earth goes around the sun. However, when you think about it, I do think that people have intellectual blinders on. You know, it is
apathy. It doesn't interest them.
Well,
certainly
they
don't care.
It is apathy, but it's also, I think, it's like inattentional blindness. It's like you don't see the things that are right in front of you if it's not part of your
the gorilla bouncing the basketball.
Yeah,
right?
It's the gorilla walking through the basketball players. Yeah,
I have to agree with Bob because I'm a guy that really enjoys Facebook and I engage with a lot of people, and I think that it's more people just don't give a damn. More people care about watching Jersey Shore or other things, and their response to something like this would be, "What do I care what goes around what?" It's really an indifference rather than an intention. Shutting it out.
Well, what's the Russians' excuse? They don't have Jersey Shore. They have what? Stalingrad Shore. Over there.
No, the evening
percent of that.
But speaking of the internet, that's actually our first news item, Bob. There's a proposal in the U.S., in the U.S. Senate, to create a law that is being termed, although this is probably not really accurate, it's being termed the Internet Kill Switch. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think I've seen that term, internet kill switch, over and over and over. It's all over the place. It sounds like a plot device for a Michael Crichton novel, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's actually turning into the equivalent of what the death panels were to the healthcare debate early in Obama's tenure. Recently, a couple of people called politicians reintroduced legislation specifically focused on strengthening the United States cyber force fields. This is known as the Cybersecurity and Internet Freedom Act of 2011. Now, an earlier version of this legislation was introduced and stalled last session, last year. I think it was May or June of 2010. And a controversy arose because some people interpreted the bill as giving the president a kill switch for the internet, literally a switch in a very easy way to essentially just turn off the internet. And actually, that was denied by the people that framed the bill. I didn't read the bill, but they claimed that it wasn't specifically written that way, and that was just a specious argument. So now, you know, cue to this earlier this year, very recently, the news broke that they were going to reintroduce this bill, and critics, of course, resurrected the kill switch hubbub, and everybody was talking about it. Now, as a FYI, you may be surprised to know that there already is a law out there that allows the president to restrict means of electronic communication. Do you guys know that?
No.
The Communication Act of 1934 allows the president to shut down wire services if there's a state or threat of war. So this actually is already out there. He can, you know, he can legally actually do – he's got broad powers in terms of limiting this type of communication.
Yeah, they didn't see the internet coming in 1934, that's for sure.
True, but still, this, you know, wire services, electronic communication, it all applies. Now, shutting down the internet, that's been in the news a lot, right? Obviously, what happened
Egypt?
In Egypt?
Yeah.
Right, the Egyptian President Mubarak ordered the shutdown of the internet in Egypt, yep. essentially killing it for several days.
Yep, Libya's internet is down. Gaddafi did the same thing.
And yeah, it's incredible. And he created not only dire economic consequences, but he prevented Egyptians from using normal channels of communication to talk about and show what the hell was going on in their country. Now, it turns out that this whole kill switch idea, as it applies to this bill in the United States, is pretty much a red herring. It's sucking the wind, unfortunately, out of what we really should be talking about. Here's a direct quote from the bill itself. Neither the president, the director of the National Center for Cybersecurity and Communications, or any officer or employee of the United States government shall have the authority to shut down the internet. Neither, none of these guys, None of these people can shut down. It explicitly says it right in there. Now, I got to say, though, that what a great job title that is. I am Director of Cybersecurity. That would be awesome.
Bob, let's talk about the plausibility of even attempting to do this.
Well, that's just it. It's not. You can't really do it. You can't really shut down the internet. Egypt has maybe, what, 3 or 4 service providers. You know, not too hard to strong arm them. The United States has like 2,000 to 4,000 service providers. There's no way anybody's going to convince all of them to stop their traffic. And a lot of these.
I'm sorry, Bob. Do you have to necessarily stop all of them? What if you just, you know, a certain percentage of them you bring down, the whole system comes down at some point, right?
I don't know actually how many of these service providers you would have to coerce, but I would think you would need to get a pretty good percentage of them. You know, I would think that you would need to get a lot. I mean, if you got a handful of them still active, then that you'd still be able to get some information through the internet. I would think. I'm not sure, but the point is that these guys are not going to listen to anybody and close their doors for any amount of time.
And what would be a reasonable situation where we even think that this would be a good idea?
Well, I would imagine a cyber attack of some sort from a foreign or rogue nation.
Yeah, I mean, the concern is, right, that there are critical infrastructure that is accessible through the internet, and somebody may figure out a way to, like, melt down a nuclear reactor or confuse air traffic control or things like that.
Yeah, there's critical infrastructures in the United States that this bill is trying to protect, like water supply, energy transmissions, financial services. These are the things that this bill are trying to address, and they're trying to basically, you know, not shut off the internet, but actually surgically disengage certain components within the internet to prevent that from being damaged. Now, Tom Kellerman is Vice President of Security Awareness at Core Security Technologies, and he's also a former security expert for the World Bank. He says, this is not Big Brother. It's not about shutting off the internet, but taking a scalpel to command control to key services to protect them. So, they're really seriously addressing the whole idea of free speech. They're not trying to limit free speech at all, and that's clearly spelled out in the bill as well. It seems to me that they're trying to make this as a protective measure. But there's other things that this bill is doing. They're going to create a new national center to prevent cyber attacks and respond to them. And it will also, and surprisingly, for the first time, require the companies or owners of these key infrastructure segments to deal with vulnerabilities they have. That was a real surprise. I mean, you've got these people, these companies, these corporations that own and operate these key pieces of infrastructure, and they're not required to deal with vulnerabilities that they have now. So in a lot of ways, a lot of these key pieces are very vulnerable, and it's not really being addressed. And this is one of the things this bill is trying to do. The thing is, though, once you get away from the hype of this whole kill switch baloney and you start looking at some of the other objections, you start coming across things that are a little bit more or maybe a lot more substantive. For example, the national security expert Bruce Schneer thinks that the bill will not help. He said the ability to kill the internet is what the bad guys want. Deliberately engineering it into the internet would harm internet security, not help it. And that's a really good point. So for an example, he cites, if you sever banks, some of our financial institutions from web access, you could have unpredictable consequences in terms of ATM activity and stock exchanges. It's literally not known what exactly the ramifications would be. So I think this seems to be worthy of much more exploration either way. We know we need to be talking about this kind of stuff. We need to shore up our network defenses. This has to be a national priority. I mean, nobody wants to wait for a cyber 9/11 for something like this to really be taken seriously. For example, did you guys know that the executive branch agencies of the government, they're probed or attacked an average of 1.8 billion times per month? That's
wow.
694 times per second. The U.S. economy loses $8 billion a year because of this. The worldwide loss has exceeded $1 trillion. So, I mean, this is serious. This is really serious. And I'm glad, at the very least, that we're really starting to take this seriously and really trying to put some money and people on this and really do what needs to be done.
But this bill might not be the solution because it sounds
no.
like the devil's in the details, it sounds like, with this
right.
bill. And it may
exactly.
be just creating situations that will result in unintended consequences, and maybe giving too much power to the government without really understanding how exactly they would use it and what the results of that would be.
Yeah, I'm worried about creating a mechanism that can be exploited by outside agencies.
Well, and I'm worried about, you know, so they come up with whatever decisions or tactics that they do. There's always some, who knows, 16-year-old kid out there is going to be able to crack the system from his home computer.
To me, the real fun in all these articles is to just go through the comments on any of these things and see which side is more hysterical, and then I know to be on the other side. Because this one was just filled with that crowd that thinks that the government is just trying to do everything to destroy all our freedoms, and this is just the beginning of the end. Yeah. And immediately that starts up, I know, okay, let me formulate an argument to show why that's not the case, and that's when I start thinking.
Yeah, I think you'll get somewhere good with that. I mean, I agree. You have to be very careful about allowing yourself to sink into any real anti-government conspiracy theory sentiment and all that. I mean, I'm worried more from a technological standpoint. I'm not so much worried about the Big Brother idea.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything sinister going on here. It's just this is a complicated problem. Unfortunately, politics tends to boil things down to it's a kill switch for the internet, you know. It's death panels. And the real debate gets obscured in the punditry, you know, which is that's what I see as most unfortunate.
Well, I agree, but before we move on, Steve, with all due respect, let me just say this, and it's on record, Mr. Lieberman, do all the kill switches you want, but you fucking touch Facebook and you gotta deal with me. So all right, let's move on.
Yeah, I was gonna say that if they wheel in some other way for me to get instant access to, you know, porn, that's fine. Just do that before they shut down the internet.
Yeah, just give us
I'd like
cabinet.
To add a pornography rider to this bill to make sure that we protect our critical pornography infrastructure during a time of national crisis. Thank you, Senator Jay Novella. All right. Let's move on, Jay. You're going to tell us why the Japanese are sending a big fishing net up into outer space.
What?
Well, yeah, let me just say that I'm just glad this is not science or fiction, because I would have called bullshit in this one from the start.
talk about not kosher.
Yeah.
Before I get to the meat of this article, let me give some background on what the situation is that preempted this.
Let me guess. They watched the movie WALL-E and they saw all that junk in space and it scared them, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, Evan, it's a big problem. Right now, there's 6,000 satellites that we know of that have been launched since Sputnik in 57, and only about 800 of them are active right now, which I was really surprised to find out how few of the ones that are up there are actually still operating. What we're talking about here is over time throughout all of these launches that we've had and all of the accidents that have happened in space, you know, small or even, you know, even having satellites crash into each other, we have a significant amount of debris that's up there. And this debris has come from stage rockets, ejected components during launch or old equipment, some from broken apart satellites, tiny flecks of paint. There's been a good amount of debris that's even been intentionally released during spacecraft separation from its launch vehicle.
There's all those alien spacecraft up there. Yeah, it's terrible.
But
don't forget, didn't China a couple years ago do a demonstration and blow up a satellite that created a huge amount of debris?
The fireworks were good, though.
Even though the launches are monitored by many governments, you know, the fact of the matter is that people can launch objects into space, and think about in the future when we have more and more companies being able to afford space launches. You know, right now we have about 19,000 objects that are larger than 10 centimeters. That's a lot of objects, but get this. Particles between 1 and 10 centimeters in diameter, we have about 500,000 of them. And things smaller than 1 centimeter, there's tens of millions. So we have about 19,000 objects orbiting the Earth right now that are of a significant size that can do damage.
But why Japan? Why Japan? Why are they the ones in charge over here? Do they have the most debris? Do they give a damn the most about debris? Why them?
Well, the question... experts. I can turn it around, Joshy, and we can talk about why isn't a lot of other countries getting involved in this. Japan happens to have the balls to commit money to a project like this where other people just flat out are not doing it. So I applaud them for actually...
No. I actually do applaud them. My question is, I was genuinely curious if they have an incentive to do this as opposed to other countries, or at least come around to their own country and say, look, we're cleaning up your shit. Chip in for this stuff.
Yeah, I actually agree with you. Number one, I absolutely agree that other countries should pay for it. I mean, if I'm correct, I think the United States is definitely responsible for a significant amount of the debris up there, number one. Number two, yeah, maybe there is a hidden motivation that we don't know about, but
How about money, Jay? They come up with a viable method to deorbit this debris, and then you sell this technology to other nations, and bam, that could be quite an industry.
That's what will ultimately solve the problem, I believe.
Yeah, they're maybe the first ones for free. Once they prove the technology, then yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Then they might charge for it.
Okay, you know, that actually makes the most sense.
Bob was coming from the angle of, so you want we should do this again? All right, so anyway, let me give you one more piece of information I found before I get into what Japan's doing that I thought was very interesting. Now, a lot of countries, I know NASA definitely is tracking space debris. The European Space Agency has a team in Germany that tracks space debris. And they've tracked everything that's 5 to 10 centimeters in low Earth orbit and 30 centimeters to 1 meter in the geostationary ring, which is about 35,800 kilometers up. So we have a few significant agencies around the world that are doing a lot of work and putting a lot of money into monitoring all of this debris. So we actually know where the bulk of it is. There was an incident with the space station where they actually had to move it out of the way of debris.
Yeah.
So the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency and a company called Nitto Saimo Company, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, they are a fishing net company that's been in business for over 100 years. They've been working for the past 6 years on building a giant net several kilometers in size to collect debris that's in orbit. So what they've proposed is that, so they have this super strong space net that they're calling it, which consists of, three layers of metal threads, each measuring about a millimeter in diameter, and it's intertwined with fibers as thin as a human hair. That's obviously to collect very small debris. I don't know if that could actually collect the paint chips and everything, but I'd imagine they would get, things at a very small size with the net that they've created. So they have planned to attach the metal net to a satellite. They would deploy it. The net would start collecting material, and it would be in an orbit where as it gets to a particular weight from collecting material, as soon as it gets to a certain weight, it'll start to lose its orbit faster and faster, and then it'll burn everything up upon reentry. I didn't hear anything or read anything about them worrying about anything making it through reentry, that they were pretty confident that anything that entered at that speed and at the trajectory that they were predicting it would come back in at, that it would burn up. So I would say this is a great idea. At the very least, I'm sure that, if it failed or didn't work as good the first couple of times, that they'd be able to perfect it. And hopefully, maybe over the next 20 years of them making attempts like this, because it is just a satellite that they need to put into orbit. This, I don't think this requires a bigger space vehicle than things we've already deployed into space. And they plan on starting this in 2 years. And I think, this could be the beginning of a slow process to clean things up. And maybe, next 10 or 20 years, we can have a significant difference in the amount of debris that's up there.
How big is this net, Jay? Did you say how big it was?
Yeah, they said several kilometers.
All right, that's pretty big. And the other question I have is, how strong does this net have to be to survive the relative velocities? Because you're talking huge velocities, these things in orbit.
Yeah, that's the thing I was thinking, Bob, is imagine that you have the net, what would you call it? Like basically just opened, and maybe it's in like a C shape as it's traveling. I don't really know how it's supposed to look like when it's deployed. But there would be particles and objects moving in all directions. Now, I know that we have the bulk of what is orbiting the Earth is going around the geostationary ring, which, if correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but that follows the equator, right?
Yeah. So it's at a distance above the equator where the orbital time is 1 day. So whatever it is staying over the same point on the surface of the Earth. But this is obviously not that. This is low Earth orbit. And the thing is, if at any given orbit, things are pretty much moving at the same velocity. So there wouldn't be a lot of relative velocity difference there. But there are things moving in crisscrossing orbits, right? So they're not all – it's not like a ring. It's just, it's almost like a swarm of bees, you know, all the way around the Earth. So it's the thing in crisscrossing orbits that could be going at significant relative velocities. One thought I had was that if this works, this proof of concept works, that's great. At least we have an option. We can declutter orbit, you know, so at least we can get to some steady state rather than just accruing junk up there. But it seems that it's an awful waste in that it's very expensive to get stuff into orbit. And so we have all of this raw material in orbit. Wouldn't it be so much better if we could figure out some way to actually make it into stuff rather than just have it burn up in the atmosphere? That probably isn't feasible anytime soon, but just would be so much more satisfying to collect all those bits of metal, you know, and melt it down and build a space station out of it, you know, rather than just dump it back into orbit.
I see what you're saying, Steve. I mean, you know, obviously it would be an incredible effort to be able to put something in outer space that could turn this stuff into something else, you know, but maybe they could bring it to the moon and just have it there as raw material for, you know,
yeah,
next
that's
generation.
True. Most of the energy to get to the moon.
That's a good idea.
Or at least more than half of the energy to get to the moon is just getting into orbit around the Earth.
Don't forget, though, the energy that you would need to expend to collect all this debris would not be trivial.
Yeah.
And that might just negate or obviate any gain you have by being out of the gravity well. So you'd have to run the equations and see if it would work to expend that much energy.
I have to be honest. Listening here as the most layman amongst everyone here and listening to you guys talk about this, it to me seems absurd. This is one of those sci-fi things that if I saw this being done in a movie, I would say, oh, come on. This obviously can happen. It's akin to me having learned that before there were satellites, they actually had ships traveling across the Atlantic and laying wire. And I was like, what? When I call my grandmother, this is traveling under the ocean all the way across, and she hears me and goes back. It's just something that I think my mind can't wrap itself around. This is, you know, I'm just in awe. I'm sitting over here listening to you guys speak about it. It's like, yeah, it's going to come into the earth. Why don't we turn it into something? Let's send it there. Let's make it happen and make it into a station. Energy divided by four equals to this. I'm just in shock. Whatever. Keep talking.
You know, Joshy, I don't disagree with your sentiment. I mean, we talk about a lot of stuff on the show, and Steve and I had a discussion earlier today where we were going on how many times have we talked about like an updated solar cell or an improved battery that never went anywhere, and you know, we really want to steer away from news items that are just like the in 10 years we might have this because of this new technological find that has happened. But the reason why I picked this, there's a couple of reasons, but the main reason was they actually said they've already been working on it for 6 years and they're planning to deploy it in 2 years. So it does sound like this is actually going to take place.
We have a time
amazing,
frame.
But it just reminds me of that. I think this was a while ago also where they said they're going to have an elevator up to outer space, and it just seems to be in the
same
boat.
Hey, don't knock that.
I'm not
hope for that one.
That is feasible.
Yeah, no, but Joshy's right. I mean, we hear this stuff all the time, though, guys. I mean, we're so romanced by possible future technology and things, and the way that the media makes it sound.
It's the jetpack syndrome.
Yeah, we've all been burned.
Well, if you want to wrap your head around some more promise of future high technology, let's talk about Watson. This is a computer system that was developed to go head to head with essentially the world champions in Jeopardy.
What is this, Watson?
So last week, the long-running television quiz game show Jeopardy ran a very special tournament in which the two greatest champions in Jeopardy's history took on a supercomputer named Watson, as you said, Steve. Watson is an artificial intelligence system that was designed by IBM. And these three competitors played three rounds of Jeopardy over 3 days. I blogged about this the day of the first game that they played, and I made a very bold prediction. I predicted one of the humans will win the tournament, but that Watson would keep it very close.
Silly human.
Yeah.
So how did I do in my prediction? I failed. And I didn't fail. I failed badly.
You didn't do it in the form of a question.
Watson, that too. Watson kicked their butts. Watson came out the clear champion.
I find your lack of faith in our ultimate robot overlords disturbing.
That's right. They are the robot overlords.
So, Evan, tell us what Watson is, though.
Watson is a system designed by IBM to work with natural language. So it's a series of computers. It's one system, but it's powered by 10 racks. Imagine this room, 10 racks of IBM Power 750 servers running Linux using 15 terabytes of RAM, 2,880 processor cores, and can operate at, Bob, you'll like this, 80 teraflops.
Not bad. Wow.
Now,
not
Bob,
bad.
For the listening audience, can you how many operations per
That's
second?
80 trillion floating point operations per second, which is it's supercomputer class. But I mean, the state of the art is much higher than that. But still, that's a hell of a lot of computation.
And we're just talking about, you know, the hardware and the basic structure of this thing. Plus, there's all the programming and algorithms that, you know, went into designing this thing, in which it had to learn how to, you know, certainly play a game and interact with people, understand language, a whole bunch of things that we humans take for granted every day, yet that are, you know, take a lot of effort on a lot of people's parts over at IBM in order to get this system up and working, in order to play a game with Jeopardy. Not just play the game, but take on the best people, the people who have had the most success playing this very competitive game. And the computer came out the clear winner.
So, Evan, what is it? Is it the software that makes this stand apart?
Yeah. I mean, the hardware is just brute force. I mean, they just lash together a bunch of cores, you know. The software is the real innovation here. And to my mind, it was mostly the natural language interface, being able to understand the questions. Although, from what I hear, oftentimes the computer, Watson, did not get the puns of the category titles, and it had to actually wait for one of the humans to answer in a category until it understood what the category was. Also, you know, some of the contestants were saying that the real advantage Watson had was, you know, 'cause you can't chime in until the question's over.
Mm-hmm.
So Watson's reaction time was consistently a little bit faster than both of the people.
Yeah, that makes sense. It just has to, you know, learn basically what's the first nanosecond that it can ring in. And it basically would do that on every single question.
Yeah, so
I'm sorry. I'm just really not impressed with this entire Watson ordeal. as someone that is really a religious Jeopardy watcher, I understand that one of the interesting things of Jeopardy as opposed to other trivia games is that inherent in every single question is a hint or a clue or a pun or a wordplay that will give the human the answer even if he didn't get the initial question right initially. But when I taped all three episodes, it was 3 days, and after halfway through the first one, I stopped watching because it was so obvious that Watson was going to be beat up on them, because the tricky part of being able to make a computer like this was, can it detect the word plays, the puns, and the tricky nature of human language? And the problem is that so many categories don't necessarily have to rely upon that. Anytime there were lyrics to a song, it immediately knew, yes, the Beatles. Anytime it was anything else, it didn't have to revert to those secondary hints and tricks which are allotted to humans.
Yeah, the big thing, being able to comb through your database, and I think the figure is it was able to go through 2 million pages worth of information.
200 million.
Per second, 200 million pages?
Sorry, no, I have researchers scan some 200 million pages of content into it, so you're probably right, Bob.
I think I read it was about 2 million a second, which is such a brute force method that it's hard for a human to compare. But yeah, and I think, Steve, you mentioned previously, though, that the key advance, I think, is generally agreed upon, was the natural language processing. The fact that we will soon or eventually have a computer that we could actually converse with.
Yeah. This was a fun stunt, right? I mean, it wasn't really about could the computer beat the humans at Jeopardy, because that's just how fast do you want to build the computer. If they used half as many cores, it would have been too slow to beat them. You know, they made it fast enough that it could crunch this massive database in real time enough to buzz in, you know, just ahead of the humans when, you know, for most of the questions, as long as it wasn't too tricky from a language point of view. I've watched a lot of Jeopardy. Some categories are punny. Some categories are very straightforward. Clearly, the computer did better on the straightforward ones. But what this really was is just a demonstration of a natural language expert system. That's basically what Watson is.
Right.
And
right.
An expert system is something that can do things like comb through massive amounts of information in a database, essentially do things that computers do well, and aid humans in tasks, you know, where you know, we are pretty good at pattern recognition and seeing connections and certain things, combing through a massive database of information is, you know, very quickly is not necessarily a strong point. That's something where an expert system, a computer, could be very effective in aiding a human in a complicated process. Like, for example, they're talking about using this kind of system to help in the practice of medicine, and sure, that would be great. But it's not meant to replace a human. I do think that we're going to see more of this in the future, but it takes a Herculean effort to gather the information into a database and to come up with a system of how the expert system, quote unquote, thinks, right? How it weighs the information. That's where the trick is. And actually, I think Jeopardy probably was, you know, low hanging fruit in terms of this kind of process. If you think about applying this to something much more tricky, like weighing signs and symptoms and deciding what disease this could be. There are already expert systems that do that and are actually very useful.
Yeah, but don't you want your expert systems like playing all kinds of games before it even starts to go down the road of having to deal with the condition of human beings?
This is a proof of concept, but there are already medical expert systems. It's not like these don't exist already.
Guys, don't underestimate the aggregate success of what Watson shows here. Now, when I say aggregate success, I mean that the team was very successful at putting together different technologies to make a coherent system. Like, you know, one of them happens to be its ability to, like Joshy was saying, you know, it had to get clues from the contestants and all that, and where some people might not be that impressed with that. I happen to be impressed with that. I like the idea that it learned how to interface with the environment that it was in. And, you know, there's obviously, guys, are specifically programming this thing to do exactly what it did right there, right? Like, I mean, I'm sure that there was unique programming just for Jeopardy. But, you know, they put together a lot of things. Great success.
I just wonder, and for me, I'll be really impressed when a computer can pick up on sarcasm, because I think that's really a distinction that humans have. Sarcasm. Ooh, yeah. Evan.
I know some people who can't do that.
Right. Yep. Sheldon.
Sheldon, yeah. Joshua, the next news item is about a new research trying to figure out how to tell when somebody is faking their remorse. But I don't think you're terribly impressed with this research.
Well, a Canadian study, and I hesitate to call it a study, has concluded which they consider the greatest study so far in remorse and how to detect when people are being sincere, when they're being apologetic, or when they're feeling bad. And it bothers me that these types of things are still taken seriously. I mean, with all the information that's out there about polygraphs and about everything, for people that are in capacities that are of importance to take this seriously really bothers me. So they had a bunch of students up there in Canada, and they had them say a bunch of things that they've done in their lives that were real, that they really regretted. And they had them do a bunch of stuff that they were insincere about their apologies for. And what they figured out was that genuinely guilty people go through a range of emotions. Happy, sad, surprised, scared, blah, 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 when they're confessing. But they're consistent and less exaggerated. But when people are faking it, there is a much higher range of emotions and exaggerations. And based on this study, they've concluded that they have what it takes to identify the people that are sincere from the insincere people. I can relate to it on two notes. First of all, I can relate to it because of something that really bothers me. On the show, yes, I'm being topical. I'm a very emotional person, and the show is 8 episodes. We lived with 16 people, and they isolated us from the world. We genuinely had no internet, no cell phones, nothing. And we became a family. We all knew each other. We loved each other. We knew about each other's families and everything. And starting from episode 4 and on, where we were already a month living with people, when a person got eliminated from the show, they would generally walk out that door and you never knew if you would see that person ever again, that you really grew to like and understand and feel for. And I'm a very emotional person, and I broke down crying every time someone was sent home. And I go through the blogs now because I like to talk to fans, I like to talk to people. And for me to see how many people are there saying, oh, it's obviously fake, don't you see this and that? And they point out specific things in my body language, and I look at those specific things, and I recognize that the exact opposite was true. The reason I did that was because that, that, and that. It was impulsive and this and that. So it bothers me so much that people become experts on body language when they're not really considering all the variables. I'm sure there's some logical fallacy to this, Steve, but I don't know what it's called.
The hasty generalization.
There you have it.
Yeah, but so yeah, what they're doing is that you can statistically make statements about what people are more likely to do when they're sincere or more likely to do when they're not sincere. But those tend to be overwhelmed by personal variables, situational variables, personality variables.
Cultural.
Cultural variables. So you may be able to raise the odds a little bit if you are familiar with an individual person's personality and their habits. But even still then, there's quirky, chaotic variables in there, factors that it's hard to account for. You should resist taking some simplistic notion about body language and then thinking that you could apply it broadly, especially to people that you don't have any personal knowledge of.
Correct. And the study made no mention of that. And I recall when I left the show, immediately I hopped on a plane and I flew to Tam. And when I got to Tam, I was in the hotel before, I think, Dawkins or someone was speaking. And as is my luck, some guy came over to me and he said, hey, do you want to be on TV? And I was like, what's this, a joke? And they pulled me and they pulled my girlfriend Mars over. And it was a show for Australian TV by a comedian called Lawrence Long. They were doing on deception. And they did a bunch of programs. I believe they had Banachek on the day before. They blindfolded him and he did a bunch of stuff. And we were sitting with the current World Series of Poker winner, Joe Cotta. He won $12.8 million a week or so before. And they tried to show how adept and how great he is at picking up bluffs from other people at the table. And this really pissed me off because I don't consider myself a professional poker player, but I am a winning poker player. And I think one of the most overrated things in poker is the ability that some people think they have in picking up bluffs on people.
Or a tell, and, someone's
yeah,
tell.
A tell, yeah, they call it a tell. And, I mean, the first thing you can see is that there are so many successful professional poker players that play online that have zero tells to go by. You're looking at an avatar online. You don't know if a person is taking extra long to place a bet because his daughter came in the room and pissed on his shoe or because the guy's nervous and looking at his cards. So there is really nothing the person can go on. But this person, Joe Cotta, who's a really nice guy, was going on and he was discussing that he can tell. He's like, for instance, Joshy now seems to me very excited. I would have to say that he probably would be holding an ace in his hand. And my question to him was very simple. I said, Joe, you don't know me. You know nothing about me. You can either deduct that I'm excited, which I may be exhibiting signs of excitement because I'm holding, let's say, a pair of aces, or maybe I'm just an asshole that would really enjoy beating a professional world-class poker player with a shitty pair of cards. How do you know that the excitement is based on those things and not the other things? He didn't really have a good answer to that, and I don't think that they were really appreciative that I was coming with a skeptical point of view towards the whole program. Yeah. So, yeah, I might have killed an episode on the BBC in Australia. No, I think they call it the ABC there. But, hey, this is where this entire thing gets infuriating, is that after conducting this study, these people actually had a seminar with parole officers to teach them how to tell when parolees were being sincere or not when they spoke to them. And to me, I mean, this is absurd. If in Canada, which is a developed country, you can have a pseudoscience like this, when you're conducting a study like this and you're teaching parole officers where people's lives are in your hands to detect whether they're sincere or not, this is like the Canadian version of men staring at goats. this is awful. And when you look further into the study, you see that they had 31 people. What a joke. They had 31 students telling them a real story and a fake story, and this is what they're basing it all like. This entire study should be renamed Wakefield Stares at Goats. This is just awful.
Yeah, I mean, it's a preliminary study. It's not certainly not definitive. It's a contrived situation, and it was small numbers. You know, before you start to, I agree, before you would even think about employing this in the real world, you know, I'd like to see some real-world studies. Like, for example, if you have videotaped confessions or interviews with real people who are being interrogated by the police, and then you know you look at the case after a fairly definitive judgment was made, so we could say as sure as we can this person was guilty or innocent. You do a really thorough, rigorous statistical analysis of certain quantifiable features, and you say, "Yeah, there's a real statistical relationship here, and it's predictive. It holds up. You know, you really come full circle." Then I would start to take it seriously. But this kind of study is just an exploratory type of preliminary study. It's not the kind of thing you base seminars on. Absolutely. Well, let's move on, Evan. Let's do Who's That Noisy.
So this is the time of the show where we play an audio clip that relates to science or skepticism in some way, and we ask the listeners to identify that noise. I'm going to play for you the noise we played from last week's show. Here we go.
By taking the human being out of the equation to a great extent and turning it over to a computer to make the decision, I guess you could also program the computer to violate a regulation.
That gentleman is named Bernard Lawrence Madoff, Bernie Madoff.
One of the best liars of the recent history, right?
That is true. He's a former American stockbroker, investment advisor, non-executive chairman of NASDAQ stock market, and the admitted operator of what has been described as the second largest Ponzi scheme in the history of the
second?
World.
Second?
Second.
Wow, I thought it was number one.
What was number
second?
One?
The American Social Security System.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
That's good one, Evan.
Wow.
Bernie Madoff, yes. Redefined Ponzi, put it in 2008, became part of our everyday vernacular again. So, yeah, he's tucked away in a nice prison for the rest of his years. So, Raina from the message boards was the first one to answer correctly that it was Bernie Madoff. So, congratulations.
What do you got for this week, Evan?
Here's what we have for this week's Who's That Noisy?
One ringing dingy?
Now, that's not just any ringing noise. You need to identify specifically what that ringing noise is. So there it is. Please post your message on our forum or send us an email at info@theskepticsguide.org. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. I think we have time for one email. This one comes from Neil Pimlet in Blackpool, UK, and he writes, "Hi guys, been thinking about this question for a while, was wondering if you could help. As I understand it, is said that matter cannot be destroyed, only changed from one type of energy to another. My question is, your brain holds lots of information such as skills, names, and other day-to-day experiences. So when a person dies, what happens to the information stored in the brain? I know you might not be able to answer the question, but would like to know your response." Well, it sounds like what Neil is asking is, it's actually something that I've read or heard a lot from the paranormal community. I don't think Neil is going here, but this basic notion that that energy can never be created or destroyed. So, you know, what happens to the energy that comprises our bodies and our specifically our memories, that they, when we die, that doesn't go away. Those vibrations sort of echo throughout eternity, and that's sort of a mechanism for a life after death or eternal life. Unfortunately, this doesn't hold up to scientific scrutiny. While matter and energy cannot be created or destroyed, but it will, you know, you can't turn matter into energy. You can turn energy from one form into another. But information doesn't follow that same rule. You can create and destroy information. So it just doesn't apply. And in fact, when energy gets converted from one form to the other, it frequently gets converted. In fact, thermodynamics says this has to happen to some degree, from a usable form of energy to an unusable form of energy, to
or less usable, maybe, right?
Yeah, just to basically you lose it loses some ability to do work. That's entropy. So entropy actually predicts that information does in fact go away.
Steve, I was wondering if my layman approach to this question is correct, because when I read this, I clearly don't know too much about this, but I saw that the mistake he's making is the assumption that matter is being destroyed. And I think, being topical, of course, one of the challenges we had on the show was that we had a recipe that was scrambled up on the board, and we had to unscramble it and turn it into a recipe. And I was thinking that if I just take all the steps in the recipe or the words and I scramble it, the recipe is gone, but nothing is really being destroyed. And I was viewing information like that. Everything is still there, but it's not there in a certain pattern that can be interpreted as to something relevant to what we would interpret as information.
Yeah, I mean that's basically right, and essentially he's just thinking within the realm of matter and energy, but there's another layer to all of this, and that's entropy and information. And when you look at that, you look at it from that point of view, then yes, information can in fact be destroyed without destroying matter, as you say, just by turning it from one form into another. When your brain rots away, you know, it gets turned into worm food and heat and forms of energy that do not carry in the information that was in your brain. That information that made up you is lost to the universe.
It's like writing on a piece of paper and then burning that paper. Once it's burned, there's no going back. There's no way to infer its prior state. It's just gone.
Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There is a theme this week.
Uh-oh.
I know how you guys love themes. These 3 news items all relate to enduring scientific controversies. So it's a piece of information coming down on one side or the other of an ongoing controversy. And I'll say what the controversy is up front. You guys ready?
Do it.
Okay, item number 1. This has to do with dark matter versus the modified Newtonian dynamics hypothesis. A new study of gas-rich galaxies precisely matches the predictions of modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOND, lending support to this competing theory to dark matter. Item number 2, this has to do with T-Rex, whether or not T-Rex was an apex predator or a scavenger. A thorough survey of dinosaur fossils suggests that T-Rex was too numerous to be a top predator and likely scavenged as well as hunted various game. And item number 3, this has to do with what caused the Younger Dryas extinction. Discovery by ground-penetrating radar of a clear impact crater in northern Canada dating to about 12,000 years ago supports the hypothetical comet impact triggering the Younger Dryas extinction event. All right, Jay.
Come on. These 3 are ridiculous, Steve. All right. That being said...
I don't even know what the hell you're asking here.
Dark matter versus MOND.
Thank you, Josh.
What, I don't know.
Waiting for someone to say that.
What's MOND? A new study of gas-rich galaxies.
Dude, is Ashton Kutcher going to come out and punk me? Is this really a question?
This is it.
It's real. I can verify that. That's real.
Predictions of modified Newtonian dynamics, lending support to the competing theory to dark matter. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay. And then apex predator versus scavenger. A thorough survey of dinosaur fossils suggests that T-Rex was too numerous to be an top predator. No, Steve. And likely
predator.
Scavenged as well as hunted various games. I mean, at least I can sink my teeth into that one. Ah! Sure.
With your little flappy arms, yeah.
It makes sense that T-Rex definitely scavenged. Why wouldn't he? That one I absolutely believe. Okay, impact versus climate change, the Younger Dryas extinction event. Okay, I get this one. What can I say about this? Like, absolutely, it's possible. I'm sure it's plausible. We're saying here that we have radar that was examining the impact crater, and they found some evidence that pointed to possibly a comet impact triggering the Younger Dryas extinction event. I think that definitely is possible. So just out of absolute blind ignorance, I'm going to say that item number one about dark matter versus James Bond is fake.
Okay. Josh, you feel up to going next?
Yeah, I think that it's not going to help me listening to anyone else. And I think this is really, really important for people to realize to get a good education early in life so you can understand half these words. So if your children are in yeshiva, take them out and put them in a real school.
Yeah, they don't even think there was 12,000 years ago. So,
yeah. Dark matter versus MOND, which I'm assuming is an acronym for something.
Which is in the question.
James MOND.
Modified Newtonian Dynamics.
Okay, yeah, that really helps me. A new study of gas-rich galaxies precisely matches the predictions of modified Newtonian Dynamics, lending support to this competing... out of here. Obviously not true. Apex predator versus scavenger. A thorough survey of the NASA files. You understand that I have a 33% chance of getting it right, and if I sound really certain, I sound really cool if I'm certain about it. So I'm just going to go with that. I mean, just... Seriously, Steve, this is what you did to me? I was excited for this portion of the show. I thought you would have something that would require intelligence, brain, something cooking. Of skeptical nature. And you give me some dinosaurs, which up until a year and a half ago, I believe, weren't the real thing. And you give me some impact in climate change. You know what?
Steve, Joshy wants to cook with butter. You gave him margarine.
That's
What's
right.
going on here?
I am going to be honest. And I'm going to say that I really don't have a clue about what you're even asking about either of these three things. But I'm going to go with item one. I'm really convinced that this is fiction.
All right. Evan?
Well, I must admit I am no expert in dark matter, MOND, Newtonian dynamics. However, I think I'm gauging that this one might be true because there's so much... studying going in now to dark matter, and there just has been, I guess, what, for 20, 30 years now, I don't get surprised when they learn, you know, new things in that direction. That as far as our friend T-Rex being predator versus scavenger, I'll quote my friend Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes. T-Rex was obviously a predator because that would just be so much cooler. I am not all that sure about this one, but the one I'm even a little less sure about is the impact versus climate change. I am pretty certain I heard something about there being a impact about 12,000 years ago, but I just don't know that they're able to link that to the triggering of this extinction event. I'm not sure that there's a clear connection there, even with new discoveries that they may have made, or maybe they turned out, Steve, that this is fiction and you're telling us the opposite. So I'm going to say that one, impact versus climate change, that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right, so let's see. The first one, dark matter versus MOND. MOND is interesting that there could be a modification to Newtonian dynamics with gravity at large scales. I could see that there could be something to that theory. I'm a little familiar with it. I don't think, though, that it's going to unseat dark matter. Because there's just too much going for dark matter. My guess is that it's going to be a best of both worlds, that dark matter will be confirmed and MOND, some sort of minor modification to Newtonian dynamics will happen as well. So it doesn't surprise me that some of the predictions of MOND are being discovered. So there's some vindication there. The third one, the impact versus climate change, you know, my knowledge of the Younger Dryas is very vague in my head. I can only go by certain superficial details of this one. The 12,000 years ago sounds about right. Using the ground-penetrating radar to find an impact crater, that sounds right. So nothing else is jumping out, but I don't know enough about the Younger Dryas to really vet that one. The second one, though, I've got a problem with number two, the apex predator versus scavenger. Yeah, my big problem is that the claim here is that T-Rex was too numerous to be a top predator. My understanding is that, I mean, I don't know how they could possibly assess the how numerous T-Rex was because so few of them have actually been fossilized. I think there's only a few full T-Rex skeletons in existence, something like that. There's just very few of them around. And even if you just calculated, if you added up the number of T-Rex skulls, there's not a lot, not as many as you would think. A lot of the skulls you see are duplicates. So there's not a lot of them. So I'm not sure how they could possibly come up with some sort of census on how many T-Rexes there were in order to make that claim. So for that reason alone, I'm going to say that the apex predator is fiction.
I wish I knew that before, I guess.
Yeah, I want to change my freaking answer.
Okay, so you guys are all over the place, right? So
yeah.
Jay and Joshy on dark matter, Bob on the T-Rex, and Evan on the impact crater. Okay. So I guess we'll take them in order.
Damn it.
Dark matter versus what? A new study of gas-rich galaxies precisely matches the predictions.
Take them in order.
Modified Newtonian dynamics lending support to this competing theory to dark matter. That one is science. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Sounded too, yeah.
So far, we still don't know everything.
So, yeah, you know, this is. I've been following this, and I'm kind of going a little back and forth myself. I mean, I agree with Bob that, you know, dark matter, there does seem to be a lot going for it, but, you know, it is, at the end of the day, sort of a big fudge factor for something that we just, observations that we can't explain with standard theories. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just that, you know, it'd be nice to actually find the actual stuff, you know.
It would be nice.
Yeah. So because it's essentially a hypothetical form of matter, it leaves open the door for other possibilities. So very quickly, you know, when astronomers observe, for example, the rotation of galaxies, they can calculate how much matter has to be in those galaxies in order to account for the gravity that they're seeing. And it turns out there's too little. There's too little matter in those galaxies. So there has to be dark matter. There's got to be matter that they can't see.
Right.
And that's essentially where the notion of dark matter came from. But the alternative is that at very large scales are the equations that we use to calculate how gravity behaves are off, that there's some variable in there that we can ignore when we're, you know, sending rockets to Saturn. But when you're talking about the movement of a galaxy, the effects become measurable, and that's the modified Newtonian dynamics, that there's some modification to gravitational theory that's accounting for the change in the rotation of galaxies from what we observe. So that's a viable alternative, logically, that could be true. This was a study done by a proponent of modified Newtonian dynamics of MOND, of Professor Stacy McGaw. They basically made predictions about how gas-rich, meaning galaxies without a lot of stars, with mostly gas and few stars, how they would rotate under a MOND theory, and the predictions did really well. So that lends support to modified Newtonian dynamics as an explanation for galactic rotations. McGaw argues that you can get the theory of dark matter to work as well, but you basically have to just arbitrarily tweak, you know, the factors of dark matter to make it fit, whereas there really isn't any reason why MOND should fit the predictions of MOND should fit the observations at all if it weren't true. So, of course, this is coming from somebody who's on that side of the fence, from
yeah,
a proponent.
I'm still
of MOND.
Not convinced.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I'm not convinced that this is like the final story and no. that MOND is true and we could discard dark matter. But this is why science is cool. This is a real debate. There are, you know, scientists who are making observations, making predictions, testing them. There are competing theories. You know, they're going to very strenuously argue for their ideas. We're sort of on the sidelines watching it unroll. And it's fascinating. And I'm getting to the point where I'm not really sure how this one's going to turn out. You know, I was sort of in the dark matter camp, but I'm not as sure as I used to be. It'd be really interesting if one day we look back at dark matter like the ether, you know, like this fudge factor that doesn't have to exist. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Right. Like the female orgasm.
You're just saying that because Rebecca's not on this week.
Steve, but don't you know, employ a false dichotomy. Like I said, I think maybe there's room for both of them to coexist,
or some other third thing that no one's even proposing.
Third thing,
yet.
Yeah,
right,
right. So
sorry,
let's go on to number two. A thorough survey of dinosaur fossils suggests that T-Rex was too numerous to be a top predator and likely scavenged as well as hunted various game. Bob, you think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Oh, yeah,
wow.
Bob.
Uh-huh, Bob. Yeah, it's right.
Good job, Evan. You got this one. So
Evan, Jupower activated.
We'll see if I got it for the right reason.
So yeah, what the hell, man?
This was exactly what I said, a thorough survey of fossils in North America. Basically, they found that T. rex was very common, where they may not have a lot of complete specimens, but they have enough specimens of different individuals of T. rex to get an estimate of, you know, how common they were in the ecosystem. And they basically said there was just too many of them around to be a top predator, an apex predator, the kind of thing, you know, that feeds – nothing feeds on it, right? But it can feed on anything, and it feeds on the largest game in the ecosystem. They were, you know, this survey, basically this was conducted by Jack Horner, who's a famous dinosaur hunter, and he.
Oh yeah, that's right. Sorry, didn't mean to laugh until I remembered he was.
He was Jack Horner from the Museum of the Rockies, and also Mark B. Goodwin from the University of California, Berkeley. They said that T. rex was equivalent in numbers to Edmontosaurus, which is an herbivore. So it couldn't have been feeding on it if it was around in the same numbers as it might. Couldn't have been relying upon that game like that, again, sort of the apex predator game. So what they're saying is that T-Rex, in order to sustain its numbers, must have also been doing some scavenging and also hunting lots of various game, you know, smaller game as well as the larger game. So basically, its place in the ecosystem was more similar to a hyena than it is to a lion, right? A lion being the apex predator in its ecosystem.
That's lame.
So T-Rex was a hyena, yeah. Which means that discovery by ground-penetrating radar of a clear impact crater in northern Canada dating to about 12,000 years ago supports the hypothetical comet impact triggering the Younger Dryas extinction event is fiction. I made that one up.
Made it up.
Oh yeah, just made it up. So the Younger Dryas. This is a
there's no Dryas.
This is a period about 12,000 years ago, after the a period of glaciation. You know, where the glaciers were melting, and then there was this die-off of megafauna in North America. The end of the Clovis culture at the same time. A culture of people known by the artifacts that they left behind. The very specific Clovis points. And the two competing theories are, well, there was some kind of either single or series of comet impacts, or maybe they exploded over the ground at that time, setting the forests aflame. And that was the result of the extinction that happened at that time. Although paleontologists say that actually the extinctions were spread out over hundreds of years and, you know, over centuries and that it wasn't really consistent with a single event like an impact. The impact theorists say that they have found the remnants, like these nanodiamonds, that are evidence of the impact, whereas the critics say that they're just misinterpreting other sort of geological particles and it's not really impact evidence. They say they think that it was just a series of climatic events, you know, surrounding the melting of the glaciers and in North America that were resulting in it, and there's essentially no need to hypothesize one or more impacts. Now, there are people out there who claim to have found impact craters. So if you go searching for, you know, impact crater and Younger Dryas, you'll find claims, but none of them are generally accepted as being either actual impact craters or of, you know, dating to the Younger Dryas. So there is no clear crater that would be like the smoking gun of a comet impact at the Younger Dryas. So good job, Evan. When's the last time you were the sole winner?
2007.
I can't remember. Bob remembers.
Not in recent memory.
So it's been a while.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I do. I picked out a special quote for Joshy. I wanted to regale him with one of my favorite quote masters, Mr. Carl Sagan. But first, this was sent in by a listener named Michael Fincher. Microbiology and meteorology now explain what only a few centuries ago was considered sufficient cause to burn women to death. Carl Sagan!
Oh, I have to add one little cute anecdote that I went on a cruise with my girlfriend Mars a few weeks ago, And Jay was saying over a quote that he had from some teacher in Sunday school in Canada or something that had a quote from one of the children that said about something about UFOs or aliens, and the little girl next to him had said, oh, aliens are not real. They're proven by science or something like that. And it was, little girl! And we were like so excited. It was our first day on the cruise, and we just kept walking around and pointing to little girls and being like, little girl! And like the parents were turning around, and I was like, no, 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 it's like this podcast thing. Don't worry, your girl's safe. It's all good. Every time we see little kids now on the streets, we're like, little girl.
Yeah, we take pride in embarrassing our listeners as much as possible.
You did great on the Norwegian Cruise Line.
Josh, you have no idea how happy in a ridiculous way that makes me, man.
Thank you guys a lot. I'm sorry Rebecca wasn't feeling well, but you really have no idea how honored I've been by this opportunity.
Well, it was a lot of fun, Josh. We actually really appreciate you coming on and putting up with everything. Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice. Theorem is performed by Kineto and used with permission.